Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, this is your host, Rick Spezak, news director of Progressive News Network, and that's the last you're going to hear me about news tonight. On behalf of Progressive News Network and my co-producer, Miss Mickey Royce, I want to welcome you to the holiday show. Tonight, we're going to leave politics behind, because every so often, although we keep our ear to the ground, we keep our eyes keen to the horizon to see that better world, to see what we may build in this world with all its challenges and its problems. As we try to work to keep our eyes on the future that may be, that will become as we work on it, from time to time, my friends, I'm sure like me, you need to leave politics behind, and that's what we're going to do tonight. Tonight, as a little gift to all our wonderful listeners, we've really achieved some wonderful things. We've helped a lot of people learn about some very important topics. We've brought you voices that you needed to hear. We've brought you stories that you would hear very few other places on the web or online. And we do this and we commit ourselves to this work because we want to build a better world with your help. We want to help you do the good work that you're doing. And one of the ways to do that is to help people become informed about the challenges that are ahead. And enough of that, and that's all for that. We've had so many wonderful guests on. We've had so much important information that we've shared with you. We're so happy that we've had you join us. Literally, we have thousands of people listening every week, and that's a wonderful thing when you consider what we're trying to accomplish on the modest scale that we are. But tonight, tonight's about holiday fun. Tonight's about unplugging from that universe and going to a more timeless universe. And with that, I want to bring on my first storyteller tonight. I'd like to welcome my wonderful co-producer, Miss Mickey Royce. Mickey, welcome.
Hi, hi, ho, 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 and all that stuff.
Well, This is a night we celebrate with all the pantheists and all those who celebrate any particular religion, whether it's a religion that says, by God, it's time to party, or you celebrate all the wonderful things that people celebrate. To one and all, we want to wish you a happy season, a happy holiday with all the wonderful things of friends and family can be around you and near your heart. So I want to thank you also, my dear co-host, Miss Mickey Royce, without whose hard work these shows couldn't be produced. Thank you, Mickey.
Well, you're very welcome, Rick, and I'm very proud and happy to be working with you. We're almost 2 years old.
I know. That's pretty neat stuff. So listen, I'm going to invite you to tell your first story, and you tell that one, then I'll bring you one of mine, and probably by the end of those, we'll be ready for our next guest, the charming and talented Miss Gwen Holden Berry of Here Be Monsters,
oh, yeah,
who also lives many, many other lives.
But
with that,
pun intended.
Absolutely. And with that, my dear Miss Mickey Royce, why don't you start telling that first story?
Okay. Well, this is the backstory. This is actually a true story. It is over 100 years old, so I think it fits in keeping with the long time ago quality. But in any case, there's an expression that you may have heard this is the story about that expression. And there was an 8-year-old girl, her name was Virginia O'Hanlon, and she wrote a letter to the editor of the New York Sun newspaper, and she got a response on an unsigned editorial actually in September of 1897. And it was the work of a veteran newsman, which is how I thought it tied in, at Frank Farsalas Church. And it's since become history's most reprinted newspaper editorial, appearing in part or in whole in dozens of languages, in books, movies, other editorials, on posters and stamps. So this is her letter, and then this is the response. Dear editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus? Virginia O'Hanlon, 115 West 95th Street. And her answer, actually, Mr. Church's answer. Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except that they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not. But that's no proof that they're not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders there are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart a baby's rattle to see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives, and he lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood.
Very nice.
Thank you. I thought it was a really great story. And it was true.
Indeed.
It's really sweet. Very sweet.
I'm going to go in a different direction. I'm going to tell an ancient fable about the Bride of Winter, the woman who married the Frost King.
That's a chilly tale.
Ah, boy, I'll tell you what. So here we go. Let's see. Here we go. The Frost Fable. Four. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Frost. A Slovak tale. There was once an old man who had a wife and 3 daughters. The wife had no love for the eldest of the 3, who was her stepdaughter, but was always scolding her. Moreover, she used to make her get up ever so early in the morning and gave her all of the work of the house to do. Before daybreak, the girl would feed the cattle and give them to drink, fetch wood and water indoors, light the fire in the stove, give the room a wash, mend the dresses, set everything in order, and then her stepmother, never satisfied, would grumble away at Marfa, exclaiming, "What a lazybones! What a slut! Why, here's not a brush in its place, and something put wrong, she left the muck inside the house." The girl kept her peace and wept. She tried in every way to accommodate herself to her stepmother, to be of service to her stepsisters, but they, taking pattern by their mother, were always insulting Marfa, quarreling with her, making her cry. That was even a pleasure to them. As for them, they lay in bed late, washed themselves in water, got ready for them, dried themselves with a clean towel, and didn't sit down to work till after dinner. Well, the girls grew and grew until they grew up and were old enough to be married. The old man felt sorry for his eldest daughter, whom he loved because she was industrious and obedient and never obstinate. Always did as she was bid, never uttered a word of contradiction, but he didn't know how he was to help her in her trouble. He was feeble, his wife was a scold, and her daughters were as obstinate as they were indolent. Well, the old folks set to work to consider. The husband, how he could get his daughter settled, the wife, how she could get rid of the elder one. One day she said to him, "I say, old man, let's get Marfa married." "Gladly," says he, slinking off to the sleeping place above the stove, but his wife called after him, "Get up early tomorrow, old man, harness the mare to the sledge, and drive away with Marfa. And Marfa, get your things together in a basket, you put on a clean shift, you're going away tomorrow on a visit." Poor Marfa was delighted to hear of such a piece of good luck as being invited on a visit, and she slept comfortably all night. Early the next morning, she got up, washed herself, prayed to God, got all her things together, packed them away in proper order, dressed herself in her best things, and looked something like a lass, a bride fit for any place whatsoever. Now it was winter time, and out of doors was a rattling frost. Early in the morning, between daybreak and sunrise, the old man harnessed the mare to the sled, led it up to the steps, and he went indoors and sat on the windowsill and said, "Now then, I've got everything ready. Sit down to table and swallow your victuals," replied the old woman. The old man sat down to table and made his daughter sit by his side. On the table stood a pannier. He took out a loaf and cut bread for himself and his daughters. Meanwhile, his wife served up a dish of old cabbage soup and said, "There, my pigeon, eat and be off. I've looked at you quite enough. Drive Marfa to her bridegroom, old man, and look you, old graybeard, drive straight along the hill at first, and then turn off the road to the right, you know, into the forest, right up to the big pine that stands on a hill, and there, hand Marfa over to Morozoko, Frost." The old man opened his eyes wide. Also his mouth, he stopped eating, and the girl began lamenting. "Now then, what are you hanging your chaps and squealing about?" said her stepmother. "Surely your bridegroom is a beauty, and hey, he's rich. Why, just see what a lot of things belong to him. The firs, the pine tops, the birches, all in their robes of down, ways and means that anyone might envy, and he himself a bogatir." The old man silently placed the things on the sled, made his daughter put on a warm pelisse, and he set off on the journey. After a time he reached the forest, turned off of the road, and drove across the frozen snow. And when he got to the depths of the forest, he stopped, made his daughter get out, laid her basket under the tall pine, and said, "Sit here and await the bridegroom. Mind you, receive him as pleasantly as you can." He turned his horses round and drove off homeward. The girl sat and shivered. The cold had pierced her through. She would have fain cried aloud, but she had not strength enough. Only her teeth chattered. Suddenly, she heard a sound. Not far off, Frost was cracking away on a fir, from fir to fir, as he was leaping, snapping his fingers, Presently he appeared on the very pine under which the maiden was sitting, and from above her head he cried, "Art thou warm, maiden?" "Warm? Warm am I, dear Father Frost," she replied. Frost began to descend lower, all the more cracking and snapping his fingers. To the maiden said Frost, "Art thou warm, maiden? Art thou warm, fair one?" The girl could scarcely draw her breath, but still she replied, "Warm am I, Frost dear, warm am I, Father dear." Frost began cracking more than ever, and more loudly did he snap his fingers, and to the maiden he said, "Art thou warm, maiden? Art thou warm, pretty one? Art thou warm, my darling?" By this time, the girl was numb with cold, and she could scarcely make herself heard as she replied, "Oh, quite warm, Frost dearest." Then Frost took pity on the girl, wrapped her up in furs, and warmed her with blankets. The next morning, the old woman said to her husband, "Drive out, old Greybeard, and wake the young couple." The old man harnessed his horse and drove off, and when he came to where his daughter was, he found she was alive, and had got a good pelisse, a costly bridal veil, and a pannier with rich gifts. He stowed everything away on the sledge without saying a word. He took his seat on it with his daughter and drove back. They reached home, and the daughter fell at her stepmother's feet. The old woman was thunderstruck when she saw the girl alive, and a new pelisse, and the basket of linen. "Ah, you wretch," she cried, "but you shan't trick me." Well, a little while later, the old woman says to her husband, "Take my daughters, too, to their bridegroom. The presents he's made are nothing compared to what he'll give them." Well, early the next morning, the old woman gave her daughters their breakfast, dressed them as befitted brides, and sent them off on their journey. In the same way as before, the old man left the girls under the pine. There, the girls sat and kept laughing and saying, "Whatever is mother thinking of? All of a sudden to marry both of us off? Then as if there were no lads in the village, forsooth! Some old rubbishy fellow may come, and goodness knows who he may be." The girls were wrapped up in pelisses, but for all they felt the cold. "I say, Praskovia, the frost's skinning me alive. Well, if our bridegroom doesn't come quick, we shall be froze to death." "Don't go talking nonsense, Mashka, as if suitors generally turned up in the forenoon. Why, it's hardly dinner time yet." "But I say, Praskovia, if only one comes, which of us shall he take?" "Not you, you stupid goose." "Then it will be you, I suppose?" "Well, of course it will be me." "You indeed. There now, have done talking stuff and treating people like fools." Meanwhile, Frost had numbed the girl's hands, so our damsels folded them under their dress, and went on quarreling as before. "What, you fright, you sleepy face? You abominable shrew? Why, you don't so much as how to begin weaving as to go on with it. You haven't an idea." "Aha, boaster, what is it that you know? Why, nothing at all, except to go out merrymaking and lick your lips, and we'll soon see which he takes first." While the girls went on scolding like that, they began to freeze in downright earnest. Suddenly they both cried out at once, "Why ever is he so long coming? Don't you know you've turned quite blue?" Now a good way off, Frost had begun cracking and snapping his fingers and leaping from fur to fur. To the girls it sounded as if someone was coming. "Listen, Praskovia, he's coming at last, and with bells too. Get along with you. I won't listen. My skin is peeling with cold." "And yet you're expecting to get married." They began blowing on their fingers. Nearer and nearer came Frost. At length he appeared on the pine above the head of the girls and said to them, "Are ye warm, maidens? Are ye warm, pretty ones? Are ye warm, my darlings?" "Oh, Frost, it's awfully cold. We're utterly perished. We're expecting a bridegroom, but the confounded fellow has disappeared." Frost slid lower down the tree, cracking away more, snapping his fingers oftener than before. "Are ye warm, maidens? Are ye warm, pretty ones? Get along with you. Are you blind that you can't see our hands and feet are quite dead?" Still lower descended Frost. Still more poured forth his might and said, "Are ye warm, maidens? Into the bottomless pit with you. Out of sight, accursed one," cried the girls. And then became lifeless, frozen forms. Next morning, the old woman said to her husband, "Old man, go and get the sledge harnessed, put an armful of hay in it, take some sheepskin wraps. I dare say the girls are half dead with cold. There's a terrible frost outside, and mind you, old Greybeard, do it quickly." Well, before the old man could manage to get a bite, he was out the door and on his way. And when he came to where his daughters were, he found them frozen. Found them dead. So he lifted the girls onto the sled, wrapped a blanket around them, and covered them up with bark mat. The old woman saw him from afar and ran out to meet him, calling ever so loud, "Where are the girls?" "In the sled." The old woman lifted the mat, undid the blanket, and found the girls both dead. Then, like a thunderstorm, she broke out against her husband, abusing him, saying, "What have you done, you old wretch? You have destroyed my daughters, the children of my own flesh and blood, my never enough to be gazed on seedlings, my beautiful berries. I will thrash you with tongs. I will give you over with stove rake." "That's enough, you old goose. You flattered yourself you were going to get riches, but your daughters were too stiff-necked. How was I to blame? It was you as yourself would have it." The old woman was in a rage at first and used bad language, but afterwards she made it up with her stepdaughter, and they all lived together peaceably and thrived and bore no malice. A neighbor made an offer of marriage, the wedding was celebrated, and Marfa is now living happily. The old man frightens his grandchildren with stories about frost, and he doesn't let them have their own way. The story of Frost.
How'd you like that one?
That'll teach you.
Well, Gwen should
be teach
going
you. No,
go ahead.
Spoil, what is it? Spoil the kid and no, spare the rod, freeze the kid? I don't know, something like that. I don't know how it went.
Yes, gives popsicles a whole new meaning.
Certainly does.
Okay, so while we're waiting for Gwen, do you have another story to tell us, another short one?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you go ahead and tell us?
I do have another short one. I think it's short. It should be short. This is the story of Panettone. Now, just in case anybody listening doesn't know, it's an Italian, it's kind of like a cake and it's kind of like a bread. And it comes from Italy around Christmas time, usually. And
should
it's
be a sweet
just very
deal.
Light. Yeah, it's just to die for. It's really wonderful. And there are apparently lots of stories. This is the one that I selected, but there's other ones. There's slight variations on a theme, but they're all romantic, and they're all this kind of a type of thing. But this tells you how Panettone started. How it came about, how it came to be. So this is the story of Panettone. Once in a little village in the hills above Milan, there was a baker named Antonio, and a very good baker he was, too. He made bread for all the people in the village, good, coarse country bread that kept the villagers from going hungry when they worked in the fields plowing and tending the grapes. Now, the baker was a widower, and he had only one daughter, a beautiful girl, but spoiled. Because her father was so very fond of her, he wouldn't let her do any work, not in the bakery or anywhere else. He wouldn't even allow her to help with the housework. All poor Serafina had to do each day was sit in her window and watch the world go by. She spent most of her time looking out into the street and to the market square, eating sweets. So she wasn't only spoiled and bored, if truth were told, she was sadly getting fat. One day in November, not long before Christmas, there was great excitement as a group of young huntsmen rode into the village looking for something to eat and drink. As Serafina leaned out of her window, her eyes met those of one of the young men, and poof, it was love at first sight. Luckily, it was love at first sight for the young man as well, and he gave her a big wink. He then sat down to talk to the old ladies, who are always to be found in Italian village squares. He wanted to find out about the lovely lady in the window. They, in their turn, the ladies, were eager to know who he was. It turned out the young man was called Angelo, and he was the son of the Duke of Milan and a very important person. So between them, Angelo and the old ladies hatched a plot so that Serafina and Angelo could meet. Angelo called for ink and paper and wrote two letters, one to Antonio and one to Serafina. And this is what they said. To Serafina, he wrote, "Dear Serafina, I love you. Soon we will meet, and I will hold you in my arms." To Antonio, he wrote, "Dear Antonio, I like your bread. Please meet me at the market square after Mass tomorrow. I have a plan that will make you rich and famous." He asked the old ladies to deliver the letters. Next day, they all met, and Angelo told Antonio of his plan to set him up in a bakery in Milan, and for him to marry Serafina. Both Serafina and Antonio thought that this was a good idea, and the next day they left for Milan. Once in Milan, Antonio and Serafina spent the day going around to bakeries of the great city. They tasted torte, pane, and biscotti, and found them delicious. The biscuits were sweet and crisp, and the bread was soft and white, and scattered with wonderful seeds. While they walked and nibbled at the bread, Antonio became more and more sad. At the end of the day, he went to Angelo and said, "I cannot make bread here. My bread is good bread, but it is bread for the workers in the hills. Your friends would not buy my bread." "Oh," said Serafina, "if only you could make bread as sweet and as rich as these dried fruits and candies." "Yes," said Angelo, "as rich and as sweet as this punch fortified with eggs and milk and honey." "That's it," said Antonio. "I'll make a bread that tastes like all of these things." And soon Serafina and her father departed back to their village with wagon loads of the biggest eggs and the sweetest honey and the plumpest raisins and fruit. All the next day, Antonio experimented and muttered to himself in his bakery. And at the end of the afternoon, he put all the dough into bowls to rise overnight. The next day, he filled every baking tray and tin in the bakery with the dough. There was still some dough left over, so he put what was left into clean flour pots and baked it in them. Soon the whole village was filled with the delicious smell of baking bread. Antonio, Serafina, and the people of the village, plus Angelo, who had ridden up from Milan, could hardly wait for the bread to be cool enough to be cut and tasted. At last, Antonio took his first bite, and everyone waited with bated breath. "Yes!" he shouted, and soon everyone was munching and laughing, and then Angelo loaded up the cart and took what was left back to Milan. Everyone in the village waited, and within the week, a cartload of new supplies came up from Angelo with a note. "My friends loved your bread, and please can you make lots more? Also, make it all in flower pot shapes, because my friends like that the best. Bring it to Milan as soon as possible, and Serafina and I will be married the next day." As soon as he could, Antonio, with Serafina, set off for Milan with lots of the new bread. As they approached the gates of the city, Antonio could hear the bells ringing, and he thought it was because it was Christmas Eve. But as he came nearer, he could hear cheers and the people calling, "Tony, Tonio, we love your bread, pane, pane, panettone." And that's why Italians always eat panettone, Tony's bread, at Christmas, and why the best panettone comes from Milan.
Very nice.
Thanks.
Very nice. Well, I've got a story called Synegerka, the Snow Child. This is a tale from Russia. Ancient fable. Snow Child. A winter tale from Russia. In a certain village lived a peasant named Ivan and his wife Mary. They were very fond of each other and had lived happily together for many years. But unfortunately, they had no children. The poor people were sad on that account. Their hearts, however, were gladdened at the sight of their neighbor's children. What could be done? It was evidently the will of heaven, and in this world, heaven's will be done. One day, in winter, after a great quantity of snow had fallen on the ground, the children of the village where Ivan and Mary lived ran into the fields to play. The old couple looked at them from the window. The children ran about and played all sorts of frolics together, and at last began to make a snowman. Ivan and Mary sat down, quietly watching. Suddenly Ivan smiled and said, "I say, wife, let's go out and make a snowman too." Mary was also in a funny mood. "Yes," she said, "let's go out and play, though we are old. But why should we make a snowman? Better to make a snow child, since heaven will not grant us a live one." "Very good," said Ivan. He put on his cap and went with his wife into the garden. They really set about making a baby of snow. They made the body, then the arms and legs, and put on atop a ball of snow for a head. "Heaven help you," cried one who passed by. "Many thanks," replied Ivan. "Heaven's help is always acceptable," added Mary. "What are you doing?" continued the stranger. "What? You see yourself," answered Ivan. "We are making a Snegurka," said Mary, laughing. Then they made a little nose and a chin, two little holes for eyes, and as soon as Ivan had finished, oh, wonderful, a sweet breath came out of its mouth. Ivan lifted up his arms and stared. The little holes were no longer holes. In their place were two bright blue eyes, and the tiny lips smiled lovingly upon him. "Mercy on us! What is this?" cried Ivan, devoutly crossing himself. The Snow Child turned its head toward him. It was really alive. It moved its arms and legs inside the snow like an infant in swaddling clothes. "Oh, Ivan," cried Mary, trembling with joy, "heaven has at last given us a baby." And she seized the child in her arms. The snow fell off Snegurka, as Mary called her, like the shell from a chicken. Mary, delighted beyond measure, held in her arms a beautiful living girl. "Oh, my love, my love, my darling Snegurka," cried the kind-hearted woman, tenderly embracing her long-wished-for and now unexpectedly granted child. And then she ran into the hut with the infant in her arms. Ivan was astounded at this wonderful event. As to Mary, she was beside herself with joy. Snegurka grew every hour, each day. She looked more beautiful than before. Ivan and Mary were delighted with her, and their hunt, once so quiet and lonely, was now full of life and merriment. The girls of the village visited them constantly, dressed and played with Snegurka as if she were a doll, talked to her, sang songs to her, joined her with them in all their games, and taught her all they knew themselves. Snegurka was very clever and quickly learned everything. During the winter, she grew up tall as a girl of about 13 years. She understood and could talk about most things around her, and had such a sweet voice that no one would ever tire of listening. Besides this, she was kind, obedient, and affectionate. Her flesh was as white as snow, her eyes looked like two forget-me-nots, and her hair was of a light flaxen color. Her cheeks had no rosy hue in them because there was no blood in her veins. In spite of this, she was so beautiful that having seen her once, you would wish to see her again and again. It would have done your heart good to see how she enjoyed herself and how happy she was when at play. Everyone loved her. She was idolized by Mary, who would often say to her husband, "Heaven has granted us joy in our old age. Sorrow has left my heart." Yvonne would answer, "Heaven be praised, but in this world happiness is seldom lasting, and sorrow is good for us all." The long winter had gradually glided away. The glorious sun again shone in the sky and warmed the cold earth. And when the snow melted, green grass appeared. The skylark poured forth its sweet notes. The girls in the village collected together and welcomed spring with a song. "Beautiful spring," they sang, "how did you come to us? How did you make your journey? On a plow or a harrow?" From a gay, sprightly girl, Snegurka suddenly became sad. "What is the matter with you, my dearest child?" Mary would often ask, drawing Snegurka nearer to her heart. "Are you ill? Are you not so happy as you used to be? Perhaps an evil eye has glanced at you." Snegurka would simply answer, "I am well, mother." The snow had now completely melted away, and a genial spring appeared with its warm and sunny days. The meadows and gardens began to be covered with radiant and sweet-scented flowers. The nightingale and other songsters of the woods and fields resumed their beautiful melodies. In a world, all nature became brighter and more charming. Snegurka alone grew sadder and sadder. She began to shun her playfellows and to hide herself from the rays of the sun, like a mayflower under the tree. She would only play near a well of spring water, splashing and dabbling in it with her hand beneath the shade of a green willow. She grew daily fonder of the shade, the cool air, and the rain shower. During rain and in the evening, she would become more gay. And when the sky became overcast with dark clouds and a thick shower of hail came pouring down, Snegurka was as pleased as any other girl would have been at the sight of a pearl necklace. And when the hail melted and disappeared beneath the warm rays of the sun, Snegurka cried bitterly, as if she would herself melt into tears, as an affectionate sister might weep over a lost brother. Spring now ended, the summer came, and the feast of St. John was close at hand. All the girls from the village went into the wood to play. Several of them came to the hut and asked Mistress Mary to allow Snegurka to go with them. Mary was at first afraid to let Snegurka go, and the girl herself did not care about it, but they could not very well refuse the invitation, and Mary thought it would perhaps amuse Snegurka. She therefore kissed her tenderly, saying, "Go, my dear child, go and enjoy yourself. And you, my good girls, please take care of my good Snegurka. You know she is as dear to me as my very sight." "All right, we'll take care," cried the girls, and they caught hold of Snegurka by the arms and ran away together to the forest. They made garlands and bouquets of flowers and sang songs while Snegurka took part in their play. After sunset, the girls piled up a small heap of dry grass and brushwood, lighting it, and with garlands in their heads stood in line, one close upon the other, they put Snegurka at the end and said, "When you see us running, you run after us." Then they began to sing and jump over the fire. Suddenly, they heard a painful cry. They turned round quickly but could see nothing. Greatly surprised, they looked at each other and then noticed that Snegurka was missing. "Oh, the mischievous puss," cried the girls. "She has hidden herself." They ran in every direction in search of her, but all in vain. They called her by name, "Snegurka! Snegurka! Snegurka!" But there was no answer. "Perhaps she has gone home," cried some of the girls. They all ran back to the village. Snegurka was not there. They searched for her the whole night, the following and the third day. They examined the forest, every tree, every brush, but to no purpose. Snegurka was gone. Old Yvonne and Mary, almost heartbroken at the loss of their dearest, beloved Snegurka. Every day Mary went to the forest to look for her lost child. Poor woman. Like a tender mother full of grief and yearning for her young one, she cried aloud, "Ah me! My Snegurka, ah me! My darling dove, where art thou?" She often fancied she could hear dear Snegurka's painful cry when she disappeared. Alas! Alas, Snegurka was nowhere to be found. Where had Snegurka gone? Had some wild beast seized and dragged her to his lair? Or a bird of prey carried her across the dark blue sea to its nest? No, neither bird nor beast had carried the girl away. When Snegurka, following her companions, sprang over the fire, she melted away and changed in an instant into a beautiful white cloud. She rose up or disappeared in the sky forever. Snegurka, the Snow Child. Did you enjoy that?
Yeah, it was kind of sad.
Well, I think it speaks to the transitory nature of things.
Yes.
Do you?
And also, it sounds like it's kind of, it sounds Russian.
It was Russian.
It sounds like that's the way they think. That's how they look at things.
Sorrow is good for you. Builds character. Well, luckily, so is joy. And tell me, do you have another little tale for us?
Well, I have a little one. It's not old, but it's little, short.
Okay.
I love it. I think it has. It's about the spirit of the season.
Well, that sounds good.
That appeals to me.
Mickey Royce, co-producer of Progressive News Network, take it away.
Okay. This is entitled "Finding That Song." And it's written by Michael Krikorian, and this was published in the New York Times Magazine several years ago, but he was a writer for the Los Angeles Times and the LA Weekly. Back in 1998, I was driving down Pico Boulevard in Los Angeles when I spotted a man lying on his back smack dab in the middle of the street. One leg was splayed onto the westbound lane of Pico, the other onto the eastbound. I got out of my car, and as I approached, I saw he was bleeding from his lower left side. I rushed to him, and before I could say anything, he said to me, "How you doing?" "How am I doing?" I asked the man. "How you doing?" I just got shot. By then, other people were there trying to help. Someone put a towel under his head. Someone called 911. I heard the sirens nearing, and I'd seen my share of gunshot wounds. I knew this wasn't life-threatening, so I went on my way. It was nearly noon, and since I was nearby, I decided to go to Langer's Delicatessen, renowned for its pastrami sandwich. I was about to turn off my car when a song came on the radio that grabbed me. I recognized the lyrics, "Just a Little Lovin' Early in the Morning." I'd heard the famous Dusty Springfield version of the song, "Just a Little Lovin'," written by Barry Mann and Cynthia Whale many times before and liked it. But this was not Dusty's version. It was smoky and jazzy and extraordinarily uplifting. So I sat and I listened to the whole song to relish it and find out who was singing. The DJ came on and said it was Sarah Vaughan. Especially after seeing a man wounded in the street, I felt my spirits raised by the song. I went to Langer's and had a number 10 pastrami and Swiss with Russian dressing. Then afterward, I called the radio station. But the person I talked to said he didn't know what album it was on. Maybe a week later, I went to Tower Records on Sunset. It had several albums from Sarah Vaughan, but none of them had that song. Years passed. I kind of forgot about it, but every now and then, I would pass a record store and take a look. Never found it. More years went by. In 2006, I went online and found some Sarah Vaughan sites. Nothing. Amazon had hundreds of her recordings, but not the one I was looking for. I posted a message on some online jazz board. I got a few responses from people saying they couldn't find it either. Some people made suggestions, but they didn't pan out. And that was the last I thought of it. Until a few weeks ago, when I found a small padded package in my mailbox. Inside was a CD with the recording of Sarah Vaughan singing "Just a Little Lovin'." It was wrapped in a sheet of paper with some type production info. The song is from the 1972 album Feelin' Good, which, as it turns out, became available online a couple of years ago. And there was a handwritten note from a man named Jerry in Amherst, Massachusetts, that said, "Enjoy." I was flabbergasted. Immediately, I loaded it into the CD player in my bedroom. I was actually a little nervous. Would it sound as good as I remembered? It had been more than 10 years, And maybe I had built it up to a legendary status when it was merely excellent. After all, discovery is usually a greater thrill than confirmation. I pushed play. Oh, sweet Sarah. From the very opening notes of the piano and her first vocals, the song was just as I remembered it. I played it 5 times, slowly dancing around my room. I couldn't wait to thank this guy, Jerry, so I got his number from 411. I'm glad you got it, he said. Then, 5 days after that, I got an email message from someone going by eallen4787. I hope this email address is still operative for you. This address was taken from a 2006 post. I, too, have been searching for a copy of Sarah Vaughan's version of Just a Little Lovin'. I used to hear it from an album that we played in graduate school at Purdue that was owned by a fellow student in 1974. I wrote back right away, and I told him the story, that I'd just gotten the recording in the mail out of the blue, and that I'd send him a copy. He wrote back, "Thank you so much. Thank God for this Internet. This is the best find by far I have ever made on the Internet." So I had my girlfriend's son, Oliver, burn me a CD, and I sent it out to eallen4787. It has been a little while now, and I still play the song every day, usually in the morning. I love the piano and Sarah's voice, but now it's more than just a song. It makes me think of the gift I got from a complete stranger, this Jerry guy, and how good it made me feel to reach out to someone else and ask for nothing in return. And it makes me think about that guy who was shot who asked me how I was doing. I hope he's alive and well, and I wish I could send him the song.
Well, thank you very much. That was another wonderful story.
Good.
I've got one more. At the end of the year, as we all think about what we've accomplished and look forward to the year ahead, age, time, families, sons, daughters, fathers, mothers, grandparents are all around. And this is a story about all of those things and something more. This is called The Water of Youth, The Water of Life, The Water of Death. In a certain kingdom, in a certain land, there lived a czar. That czar had 3 sons, 2 crafty, the 3rd simple. Somehow the czar had a dream that beyond the 9th land, in the 13th kingdom, there was a beautiful maiden from whose hands and feet water was flowing, that whoever would drink that water would become 30 years younger. The czar was very old. He summoned his sons and counselors and asked, "Can anyone explain my dream?" The counselors answered, "We have not seen with sight nor heard with hearing of such a beautiful maiden, nor how to go to her. This is all unknown to us." Now the eldest son, Dmitri Tsarevich, spoke up, "Father, give me thy blessing to go in all 4 directions, look at people, show myself, and make search for the beautiful maiden." The Tsar gave his parental blessing. "Take," he said, "treasure as much as thou wished, and all kinds of troops as many as are necessary." Dmitri Tsarevich took 100,000 men, set out on the road, on the journey. He rode a day, he rode a week, he rode a month, and 2 and 3. No matter whom he asked, no one knew of the beautiful maiden. He came to such desert places, there were only heaven and earth. He urged his horse on, and behold, before him is a lofty mountain. He could not see the top with his eyes. Somehow he climbed the mountain and found there a gray old man. "Hail, grandfather," he said. "Hail, brave youth. Art fleeing from labor, or seekest thou labor?" "I am seeking labor," he said to the old man. "What dost thou need?" said the old man. "I have heard that beyond the 9th land, in the 13th kingdom, is a beautiful maiden from whose hands and feet healing water flows, and that whosoever gets and drinks this water will grow 30 years younger." "Well, young brother, thou canst not go there." "Why not?" he said. because there are three broad rivers on the road, and on these rivers three ferries ride, and the first ferry they will cut off thy right hand for a price. The second will cost thee thy left foot, and the third they will take thy head for the price. Dmitri Tsarevich was grieved. He hung his stormy head below his shoulders and thought, must I spare my father's head? Must I spare my own? I'll run back. He came down from the mountain, went back to his father and said, no, no, father, I have not been able to find her. There is nothing to be heard of this maiden. The second son, Vasily Tsarevich, began to beg, father, give me thy blessing. Perhaps I can find her. Go, he said, go, my son. So Vasily Tsarevich took 100,000 men. He set out on the road on his journey. He rode a day. He rode a week. He rode a month, two and three, and entered such places that there was nothing but forests and swamps. And there he found Baba Yaga, Bone Leg. Hail, Baba Yaga, Bone Leg. Hail to thee, brave youth. Art thou fleeing from labor, or dost thou seek labor? I have heard that beyond the ninth tree land, in the 30th kingdom, is a beautiful maiden from whose hands and feet healing water flows. There is, father, only thou canst not go there. Why not? He said. Because on the road there are three rivers, and on these rivers there are three ferries. The first ferry they will cut off thy right hand, the second will cost thee thy right foot, and the third they will take thy head. It's not a question of saving my father's head, but sparing my own. He returned and said to his father, no, father, I could not find her. There is nothing to be heard of that maiden. The youngest son, Ivan Tsarevich, began to beg, please, father, give me thy blessing, that I may find her. The father gave him his blessing. Go, my dear son, take troops and treasure, all that are needed. I need nothing. Only give me a good steed and a sword, Kladinetis. Ivan Tsarevich mounted his steed, took the sword, Kladinetis, and set out on his way, on the journey. He rode a day, he rode a week, he rode a month, two and three, and rode into such places that his horse was to the knees in water, to the breast in grass. And he, good youth, had nothing to eat. He saw a cabin on hen's feet, and answered, inside sat Baba Yaga, Bone Leg. Hail to thee, grandmother. Hail, Ivan Tsarevich. Art thou flying from labor, or seekest thou labor? What labor? I am going to the 30th kingdom. There, it is said, lives a beautiful maiden from whose hands and feet healing water flows. There is, father, though with sight I have not seen her, with hearing I have not heard of her, but to her it is not for thee to go. Why so? Because there are three fairies on the way, and the first fairy they will cut off thy right hand, the second will cost thee thy right foot, the third will take thy head. Well, grandmother, one head is not much. I will go wherever God gives. Aha! Ivan Tsarevich, better turn back. Thou art still a green youth, hast never been in places of danger, hast thou not seen great terror? No, said Ivan, if thou seizest the rope, don't say thou art not strong. He took farewell of Baba Yaga, Bone Leg, and went farther. He rode a day, a second, a third, and came to the first ferryman. The ferryman was sleeping on the opposite bank. What is to be done? Thought Ivan. If I shout, they'll be deaf for the rest of their lives. If I whistle, I shall sink the ferryboat. He whistled, but a half whistle. The ferryman sprang up that minute and ferried him across the river. What is the price of your work, brothers? Give us thy right hand, they said. Oh, I want that for myself. Then Ivan Tsarevich struck with his sword on the right and on the left. He cut down all the ferrymen, mounted his horse, and galloped ahead. At the other two ferries, he got away in the same fashion. He was drawing near the 30th kingdom. On the boundary stood a wild man, in stature tall as a forest, the thickness equal to a great stack of hay. He held in his hands an enormous oak tree. Said the giant to Ivan, whither art thou riding? I am going to the 30th kingdom. I want to see the beautiful maiden from whose hands and feet healing water flows. How couldst thou, little pygmy, go there? I am 100 years guarding her kingdom. Great, mighty heroes came, not the likes of thee, and they fell from my strong hand. Who art thou, just a little worm? Ivan Tsarevich saw that he could not manage the giant, he turned aside. He traveled and traveled till he came to a sleeping cabin. In that cabin was an old man who was sitting. She saw the good youth. "Hail, Ivan Tsarevich, why has God brought thee hither?" He told her without concealment. The old woman gave him a magic herb and a ball. "Go out," said she, "into the open field and make a fire. Throw these herbs on it, and take care to stand in the windward. From these magic herbs the giant will sleep a great sleep, and then cut his head off, and let the ball roll and follow. The ball will take thee to those regions where the beautiful maiden reigns. She lives in a great golden castle, and often rides out with her army to the green meadows to amuse herself. 9 days does she stay there. Then sleeps a hero sleep 9 days and 9 nights. Ivan Tsarevich thanked the old woman, went out to the open field where he made a fire and threw into it the mighty herbs. The stormy wind blew the smoke to where the wild man was standing on guard. It grew dim in his eyes, and he lay on the damp earth and fell. Ivan cut off his head, let the ball roll, and rode on. He traveled on and on until the golden palace was visible. Then he turned from the road, let his horse out to feed, and crept into a thicket. He had just hidden himself when dust was rising on a column from the front of the palace. The beautiful maiden rode out with her army to amuse herself in the green meadow. Ivan Tsarevich saw that the whole army was formed of maidens alone. One was beautiful, the next surpassed that one, fairer than all, and beyond admiration was the Tsarevna herself. 9 days was she sporting in the green meadow, and her with her army. The Tsarevich did not take his eyes from her. He still would not gaze his full. On the 10th day, he went to the golden palace. The beautiful maiden was lying on a couch of down. He kissed her. She awoke, and he took the waters of youth. They married. He returned and gave his father 30 more years. Thank you very much. Without any further ado, I do want to welcome on our dear friend, Gwen Holden Berry. Gwen, my dear, welcome.
Thank you. I'm so sorry to be late. If we can leave the mic open, I'd be very willing to read my Yule legend by Lark the Bard.
Well, do me one favor. I'd like you to first give us a benediction of the season, because the broadcast is going to close in about 3 minutes, but then you can go on and tell your story, and what we'll do is that'll be up when we post it. Your whole story will also be up, okay? So if I could ask you as a student of the cosmic eternity to give us some small blessing of the season.
Bless the world. We're open to a brand new energy that's flowing through and down and onto the planet, and you can see it in all of the remarkable events that are taking place right now. There's a lot of light coming, a lot of light that's already been shown to us. So I would say blessings to everyone. Just take heart and be of good cheer, because it's time to be.
Well, thank you so much, Gwen. And if you hold on for a moment, I'll let you tell your story. But we're going to be losing our audience in just a moment. I want to thank you on behalf of myself and on behalf of my good co-producer, Mickey.
Yes. Ho, 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 once again.
We hope you join us again next year on the 3rd. We're going to return. We'll be back to politics. We've got so many news stories to tell you. In fact, so many that just have been arriving. Ha, ha. But no news tonight, just the eternal tonight. Thanks so much. Tune in. Join us again on the 3rd of January in the year 2013. Thanks a lot. And for those of you who tune in later, the final broadcast will include a wonderful tale by our dear friend, Gwen Holden Berry of Here Be Monsters. Gwen, why don't you go ahead, take it away, my dear.
Well, I'm not such a fabulous reader as you, but I'll give it my best try, because this is a Yule legend written down by someone who is following a new druidry path. His name is Lark the Bard, and he wrote this several years ago, and it's the telling or the myth that our ancestors, as they might have known it, about you. So, long, long ago, when the earth was new and mankind was younger yet, there came a time of dark and cold, let never a soul forget. There came a time when the ice drew nigh and the sky with snow turned gray, and the earth grew hard and the trees were bare, and the timber wolf howled in the bray. Huddled and cold, the tribesmen sat round fires of peat and moss, and dreamed of the warm time, dreamed of the Lord, and mourned for the lady's loss. With the harvest had come the Lord, and laid his body down, to pay with his life for the earth's repast, to yield to the holly his crown. As the deer and the boar bow down to the bow, and the stag consents to the kill, so the Lord came down to the altar knife, earth's riches his people to fill. Then came the lady across the moor and down from the lonely hill, saying, "What have you done with my wondrous Lord, and why did you have to kill?" Then in anger she turned away from the children of men, and in anger she went away, and she wrapped her cloak around her head, and she wrapped the sky with gray. Cold grew the world with the lady's grief, and her cold tears fell as the snow, and the rivers and lakes were frozen still, and the peat fires burned low. "Oh, what have we done," the people cried, "to slain our own dear Lord? And how will we live and how will we fare without the lady's regard?" The world grew colder each passing day, and the sun fell down from the sky, and darkness eternal lay over the earth, and the people began to die. They gathered around there on the plain, every woman and man and child, and prayed to the lady then to relent, and prayed for the land to heal. But nothing came to answer their cries but dire wolf, lion, and bear. And the people cried with a terrible shout, but the lady refused to hear. Then from among them a man stood forth, a harper of no little fame. And he said, "I shall go to the summer land's shores, and I'll bring the Lord back again. And how will you do this thing you will do, and how will you bring it about? I will play on my harp till the gates open wide, and the Lord Death shall let us out." Old fool, the wise ones cried, "Oh, never this thing shall be, for no one goes to the summer land shores and returns to the land of the free. But I shall go," the old man said, "and these things I claim shall be, or else the world and dark will die and the people will no longer be." Then he took his harp and he took his staff and he bent his head to the west, and he walked and he ran for 6 days and three, and never he stopped to rest. He ran till he came to the frozen shore of the mighty western sea, and the frozen tears coursed down his cheeks, for never a boat had he. And then the man cried out in a terrible shout, "Aquila, Lord of the air, hear my plea and answer me and bear me over there." Out of the skies on the wings of fire came Aquila, the Lord of the air, saying, "Who shall call on Aquila's name and bid me carry them there?" "I," said the old man, "I called thy name for my people. The need is great, and I must hie to the summerland shores if ever I would avert their fate." Then Aquila came down to the shores of the sea, and he came to the old man's hand. And he said, "I shall bear thee in honor and pride to the shores of the summerland." Then off they flew in the night dark sky, neath the cavern of stars and air. And at last they came to the Silver Land shores, and a pool of light there. "My thanks for your aid," the old man cried. "Now fly and avert your fate." The proud Aquila dripped down his head and said, "For him it was too late. For from the Summer Land none return until it is time to be born. And now in the dark of the lady's regard there will be no glorious morn. And come," said the harper, "come with me, and we'll seek the Lord of the Wild." And he struck his harp, and he raised his voice, and the shades of the dead, they smiled. They searched and they searched the summer land, and the harp made a wondrous sound, till they came to a grove of oak, ash, and thorn, and a mighty stag they found. "Whence came you then?" cried the mighty stag, "and why have you called to me? For I was the lord of the greenwood once, and now you've awakened me." Then the harper knelt, and he bowed his head, and he cried, "O Lord, return, for thy people die without thy aid, and the fires refuse to burn. The lady mourns, and her frozen tears have turned the world to ice. We accept it gladly, your wondrous gift, with no thought to the sacrifice." The stag, he wept for his people's woe, and he bent his lordly head. "Ah, glad I would be to go with you hence, but this is the land of the dead. And none can leave here until the time when death shall let them go. And I must stay till the stars say that it is time to go." Then the harper sang, and he played his harp with ever a song so sweet, that even the Lord of Death came round and sat at the harper's feet. And when he'd done, Death came to him, saying, "Ask me for any boon, for thou hast brought me joy and peace in my lands of endless noon." Then up spoke the harper, "Lord, grant me one gift, and set the forest lord free, lest all his people perish beneath the snow. This I would ask of thee." Then Death bowed his head and said, "He may go, though it is not time yet to be. Yet I have promised for thy harper's sake, and therefore so mote it be." Death then turned to the mighty stag, and he raised his withered hand, saying, "Thou art free for the harper's sake. Depart from the summer land." Then in the place of the wild beast lay a tiny newborn child, and the harper and eagle in homage knelt, and the little baby smiled. The harper lifted him up in his arms and strode to Aquila's side and said, "I beg you one last time, for the Lord's sake, let us rise." Then Aquila rose from the summer land with harper and child on his back, and he turned his head to the eastern lands, and he sailed into infinite black. 9 days and nine Aquila flew till he came to the cold, dark plain. And there he carried the man and child, that the sun might come again. Then down from the darkness they came with the wind, and among the people they stood. And the people came forth to see this child. Yes, they would. Then the people called out the lady's name, and the newborn baby cried. And the lady looked down on the gathering throng, and she saw the child and sighed. "Ah," said the lady, "here is my lord. Surely come back to me. And where are the brave ones who challenged death, that this wondrous thing might be?" Then forth came Aquila and Harper both, and stood at the lady's feet. "Thou art the bravest and staunchest of friends that ever I chanced to meet. For thou hast challenged the gates of death, with never thought of reward, and thou hast won the people's life for saving my own sweet lord, who king shall be, and I give thee a crown of life. and she stretched forth her hand upon his head and turned his feathers white. And thou, dear Harper, shalt be my own and sit here at my feet. And a nightingale sang when the old man stood with ever a song so sweet. Then spake the lady to those who heard, by fire and fir and yew, I vow on my honor, and never again will the light depart from you. For thou the night grows long and dark, and the sun be hid from view. Yet the Lord will come with midwinter's day and bring light back to you. Then she bade them build on the frozen stone a mighty and magical ring of standing stone and sturdy oak, and she bade the people sing. And she said, by this mark you shall be sure that to my promise I hold, for when the sun on the stone shall sit, then you'll know an end of the cold. Down and down the dark shall come, but on that special day, the sun shall climb once more in the sky, and the heavens be blue, not gray. Then the people knelt, bowed their heads, and when they looked again, the lady was gone, and the harper too, gone from the world of men. And in the place where the lady stood, the rose of winter grew, and overhead where the sun shone bright, a mighty eagle flew. And thus, my children, thus is the tale of how the world turned cold and how the summer was carried back by the harper and eagle bold. And that's the tale.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
It's a goodie.
Thanks so much, Gwen.
You're most welcome, and a very happy Yule and Merry Christmas and Happy Hanukkah and all of that to both of you.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you. Same to you.
Your spirit and your time has been a real blessing on the show, and we sure appreciate all your time and wish you also the happiest of holiday seasons. May all your loved ones be around you and your cup of joy overflow.
Oh, thank you, Rick. Thank you so much.
Well, good night, Gwen. Good night, Mickey. And good night, our wonderful audience. We hope you've enjoyed the show. I hope it brings you lots of listening pleasure. And we'll see you on the 3rd of January, where we discover with our adventures how we're going to build that better world. So thanks so much for joining us. Good night on behalf of Rick.
Mick.
And Gwen.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night. Okay, and let's hear this.
Fly specks. Fly specks. I've been spending my life among fly specks while miracles have been leaning on lampposts at 18th and Fairfax.